Let's learn the Tiferes Shimshon and Parshas B'Shalach on the Pasuk Matitzak Eli, Dabar Bnei Yisrael V'Yiso. At this historic moment, Klal Yisrael had the raging sea in front of them, and they start davening to the Rabbeinu Shlem to save them as they see the Mitzrayim running in one direction towards them, and the sea is behind them, and they have no idea what's going to be, so they start davening. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to them, what are you davening for? What are you screaming to me for? Dabro Bnei Yisrael V'Yiso, just go, tell Bnei Yisrael, just move. Like, now's not the time to daven, now's the time to go. HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitzav al Moshe lahafsik lispalel, ulahiris lam Yisrael lahaskel anu akadima. Here Hashem commands Moshe to stop davening, enough of the tefillahs, put it away, and just move forward. V'achein, Nachshon ben Aminadav, hayaharishen shekaymis dvar Hashem nichnas layam. Nevertheless, Nachshon ben Aminadav was the first one who actually listened to Hashem. He was the one that jumped into the yam. V'kasher olu hamayim zoak, and when the water was like rising around Nachshon ben Aminadav's head, he says, hashieni elikim kivo maimad nefesh. Pasuk and Tehillim, save me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because the water has come up to my nefesh, meaning it's coming up to my nostrils. I'm not able to live anymore from this water. The oz nivkayam. And as soon as he davened, then the sea split. So it's a fascinating thing. Klal Yisrael was told not to daven. It's not the time to daven. Just go. Nachshon ben Aminadav, he jumps in. And what does he do? He davens. So Hakama was good for Nachshon ben Aminadav, his tefillos were answered, but not Klal Yisrael. Madu al tefillos Moshe nemar matzitzak elai. Moshe Rabbeinu was davening, Klal Yisrael was davening. Stop davening. Ulacher mikena yitzarech has tefillos Nachshon ben Aminadav kdei shivaka hayam. In order for the sea to split suddenly, you need a Nachshon ben Aminadav's tefillah. Yiseiru mizu. And a better question is, Hari Pam Hayakayim Musak Shnikra Raisin Himlin. Raisin Himlin Kleimar Lakrayas Hashemayim. Raisin Himlin is like a Yiddish expression that means to tear, to rice, means to, like to rice kriya, means to tear the heavens. What does that mean, to tear the heavens? Excuse me. What?
No.
Kasher Haisa Neifelas Chas Vishom Tzara Ala Mishpacha. When Rachman Litzan, somebody has a big tzara in the family, hayu b'nei habayis mispartzim l'beis haknesses. So the b'nei habayis, they come and they race to the shul. What do they do? Paischem es aron hakodesh. This is back what they used to do in the olden days. It's an old minig in Klal Yisrael. They would go and open up the aron hakodesh. V'zayakim b'tfilah me'aymek halev, and they would start screaming into like the Aron HaKodesh. They would stick their head into the open Aron HaKodesh and they would start screaming from the depths of their heart, umitech b'chiyos, and from crying. That was a minig, that if you really wanted to get Hashem's attention, as it were, if you really need something desperately, this is what you do. You rise in Himlin, you basically tear apart the heavens. You go to your local shul, you open up the Aron HaKodesh when nobody's around, preferably, and you just cry and you daven like the world is coming to an end for you. Echa mir rabbeisai sipur. In fact, says Rav Pinkus, one of my rabbeim told over ketzad b'mir hayabacher chayla. Once upon a time in the Mir Yeshiva, there was one of the bachrim that were sick. Ve'imai paschas aron hakodesh v'zaka, and the mother opened up the aron hakodesh, I guess in the mir maybe, and she started crying. Nowadays, people don't do that. There is a nice minig by Svardim, right? Svardim, they go up, I think, after davening. Is that, I don't know if all Svardim do this, but I've seen a lot of times.
Just to kiss the
Heichal? Just to kiss the Heichal. They basically go and they daven a little tefillah right by the curtain, right? Right by the parechas, and then they walk backwards. And is that a minig that every Svardi does in, every day?
No. I know Israelis
sometimes
do so. Just some Israelis. I'm not sure.
Israeli. Yeah, but it looks very, it's nice. It's like a personal relationship with a Rabbeinu Shalom. But that is, but the.
Into quite quiet places and just...
You could, but this is a much more dramatic thing. Like, it's like, this isn't for an everyday occurrence. This is, you know, when you really, really need to do something badly. And, you know, the nice thing isn't working anymore. You got to go and you got to... That's what they used to do in the old days.
I'm saying, Breslau goes into...
Breslau. They go into, like, the woods.
And then they do...
Right.
And actually, the quad is a good place for that.
The quad?
No, by the fields.
Okay.
At night time, Dafka.
Okay, so kayaim kvar leiraim in exat. Nowadays, we don't see people doing this. Achal kol ponim, but nevertheless, be'es tzara zayikim al Hashem. One thing is clear, that when there's an esara, we scream to Hashem, like it means like everything to us. Ve'ilu kana kadosh baruch hu aymer l'maisha matitz agela. And yet, you find that Moshe Rabbeinu was told, what are you screaming to me? Hadavar medarsheni, and this matter requires some analysis. So he says that the explanation might be based on the Zayar. The Zayar says, when Klal Yisrael were standing opposite the Yam, at that point in time, they required a great amount of chesed. At this point, it was too late. Davening was not cutting it anymore. They needed like extra amounts of chesed. Hef sharas heichida li natzal b'yis ha-shah, ha-yisal lifo b'mesiris nefesh, dabra b'nei yisrael v'yisau. There are times in life that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says davening is not enough. Davening is not enough. It's a very, very critical time. And now you need like heapfuls of chesed from the Rabbi Nishlam. It's not a regular occurrence. It's like a major, major thing that we're begging for. We need a lot of chesed and a lot of rachmei shamayim. And the regular tefillos even won't help because it's just not going to cut it. You need much more than that. You need to pull out the heavy artillery. What's the heavy artillery when it comes to getting HaKadosh Baruch Hu's attention? What do you do? How do you get HaKadosh Baruch Hu's attention? You need something really badly. What do you do to show HaKadosh Baruch Hu that I'm going crazy? I need you to help me. Ha'isalifo b'mesiris nefesh. The only way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu always pays full attention, as it were, he's always paying attention, but if you really want to get his full attention and you really want results, you have to do something that's an act of mesiris nefesh. When you go out of your natural tevadika approach to life and you say, I'm giving it all, I'm willing to do like the go the nth degree to do what the Rabbeinu Shalom wants, I'm willing even to be meiser nefesh, so at that moment in time there is a new rachamim that comes down from Shamayim. L'iskade mel toich hayam mitoich muchanos limsar es hanefesh. If you're willing to die for something, HaKadosh Baruch Hu paid, that's a different madrega. It's not like I'm just some opening up my siddur and like davening, I'm pretty pleased. This is something like, I need this and I'm willing to put everything on the line for this. This is what I need, this is what I'm begging you, and I'm willing to give up my life for this. If anyone is willing to say that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, okay, I hear. You know, sometimes a child is crying to a parent and like, you're not in the mood to, you're just not in the mood to give in because you feel that the child is something really badly and you're not inspired or motivated at all to help. But sometimes like the child will say, you know, will like start screaming and going crazy and like, you know, like, I want to kill myself or something like that. And like all of a sudden like, okay, it's time, you know, we have to stop. That we have to fix this relationship now. When a person is willing to be meiser nefesh for something, to give up his life, it creates a much higher level of tefillah. Tefillah levadei lehaisa mesugeles leishim b'matzav b'hayu. A regular tefillah alone was not enough. It didn't do the trick to save them in that terrible predicament. Hem nizkaku l'maisim. They needed to do something l'maisim. They needed to show an act of mesiras nefesh. That was the only way to do something. Hamahus shel kriyas yamsuf. Haisa matzav shel chayser breira muchlot. That matzav of kriyas yamsuf was definitely, there was no choice. L'lai maitza. Barash and matzav zayish litzak al Hashem. It's true. Of course, you have to daven to Hashem at this crazy situation in life. You have the sea on one hand, you have the mighty Egyptian army on the other. You're sandwiched in between these two threats. Of course, everyone's going to daven to the Rabbeinu Shalom. But there has to be another to get HaKadosh Baruch Hu's full attention, to do a Reis in Himlin, to tear open the heavens, and to really do something that's like over and above the norm, we had to do an act of Mesiras Nefesh. V'lachein la'acher she'Nachshon ben Aminadav pal b'Mesiras Nefesh, once Nachshon ben Aminadav accomplished something with his Mesiras Nefesh, his kablo tfilosai v'ayam nivka. At that point, the tefillah was niskabel, the tefillah was accepted in the yam Torah. So he davened also, but you can't compare the two types of davenings. There's a davening and then there's a davening. There's a davening that I'm just opening up my siddur and or my tillum and I'm just saying the words. And then there's something that I'm doing something active. I'm mamish jumping into the yamsuf in order to do it. And then when I daven at that matzav, it's a different tefillah. A regular tefillah sometimes doesn't help, but when a person goes and he's mamish, you know, completely focused on this is, I have only you, and there's nothing else, and here is my act of Mesiras Nefesh, I'm willing to die for it. When a person does that, that creates a very big stir in Shamayim. Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the Maisa with Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, Hashem Yinkam Damav. Rabbi Chanan was the Rosh Yeshiva of Baranovich. He's a Talmud of Rabbi Chaim Brisker, he's a Talmud of the Chafetz Chaim, and he was in America at the outbreak of the war. He was here for fundraising purposes. And then the war broke out. And the people here were begging him, the Yidden here were begging him to just stay in America. It's crazy, you're gonna die there. They're killing Jews left and right. They knew already the news of what was going on. And it's a very dangerous, you can't put yourself in a makam sakana, you have to stay in America. And people were willing to like Rosh Yeshiva said, like, we'll give him our position, just as long as he stays in America. I think he was offered to be Rosh Yeshiva in Tarvadas, maybe some other yeshivas, and he basically, you know, they gave him very good offers with a nice parnasa, and he said, no, I can't. He said that my yeshiva is in Europe, my yeshiva is in Baranovich, they're in trouble. He says, and a captain is the last to leave a sinking ship. Captain doesn't leave the ship first. And they're waiting for me, and they need me there, they need my leadership, and I have to go back. So he went back on the boat, and then he went to England on the way. He stopped off in England for the yeshiva, and then on the way to England, he went to Europe. It's a famous picture in great Jewish photographs of Rabbi Chanan at the helm of the boat from England. There's a lady next to him with like a real, I don't know who she was, I don't know, but she was wearing like a British sort of hat that women wore. But it was a very good picture to tight shop because he was the one that said that a captain doesn't leave a ship. So here he is on the front of a ship, and you know, as it's about to leave, that was one of the last pictures, unfortunately, of Rabbi Chanan. So Rabbi Chanan came back to Lithuania, to Eastern Europe, and then he was going from city to city, and in the end he ended up in Slabodka. Slabodka was a little suburb of Kovno. Kovno was like a much bigger city. Slabodka was a little hamlet off of Kovno, but Kavna was zeicha to have tremendous gedalim as their rabbanim. He had the Dvar Avram, Rabbi Yisrael Chanan Spector, Rabbi Yisrael Chanan son. Tremendous gedalim in Kavna was a big city. And then over the bridge from Kavna is Slabodka. Slabodka is a little city, but it had perhaps the greatest yeshiva in the history of the world. So that little yeshiva in Slabodka was a hothouse of Gedolei Yisrael, future Gedolei Yisrael. You had the Altiv in Slabodka was the head of the yeshiva, founded the yeshiva. Moshe Mordechai Epstein was the Rosh Yeshiva that taught, you know, Shiurim and things. And out of that yeshiva, we know what the success of that little... Navardik was also very... But Navardik had like, you know, 75 branches, I think, throughout Europe. And Slabodka had just one yeshiva, then they moved. They opened a branch in Chevron later, but... It was one building, one little, it wasn't a big building, it was a small type of house almost. And from that little Beis Medrash, with under the watchful eye of the Altiv in Slabodka, we have Rav Aaron Kotler, Rav Shach, we have Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, we have Rav Ruderman, Rav David Leibowitz, Rav Ramelia Kaplan, Rav Huttner, who else? A lot more, but that, what?
Pesach Pushkin.
Okay. Anyway. Yeah. So anyway, they have tremendous gedolei olam that came out of this one little place. So obviously they were doing something right. They knew how to be mechanech people there. So if you'd have yeshiva that produces one of these gedolei olam, it would be remarkable. But if you have one yeshiva that produces all the gedolei olam in the whole world, there's something really special about that yeshiva. And Rav Shach used to say that all the Torah and Eretz Yisrael in America is a result of the Altiv in Slabodka. He was the man. And there are interesting, a lot of stories about him. I always wanted to write a biography about him because he's a major, major guy. I don't think there's maybe one old biography that was written, but it didn't really do justice. I think like that somebody should write about, maybe Mayer wants to write a biography someday. But, you know, just collect all the stories and all the mussar and get, like, a really good, tfis on this man to figure out what he did and, you know, learn the secret sauce of being mechanech Gedolei Yisrael. Be a tremendous thing. He was a brilliant mechanech, was a brilliant mind that understood people. And he each Talmud, he didn't do a cookie cutter mold of every single Talmud, assume every Talmud is the same. He learned about each Talmud. He knew the Milos of every Talmud, the Chisarn of every Talmud, and he knew how to play different Talmudim against each other to be Ma'ir, certain Kinasei from. He knew which Talmudim needed his Kirva, and he knew which Talmudim needed his Richuk. I mean, if a guy was like a Balgaiva, he would sort of not have so much to do with him so that he could feel a little humble, and if a guy didn't have that much going for him, he was Makarivim to build him up. He knew exactly how to make everybody come out of Slabodka perfect. So anyway, in this city of Slabodka, Rabbi Chanan found himself in hiding because they were looking. He was like one of the number one targets on the Nazis' list to track down, to hunt down. And he was in a house that was the family of Rebbetzin Kotler. Rebbetzin Schneer Kotler's wife was, Schneer Kotler's Rebbetzin, I should say, she was a freedman. And her parents owned this house in Slabodka. And in this house was hiding Rebbe Chanan, One second. I think the Teres Avram, I think, might have been there, possibly. I'm not sure. Rav Avram Gudzinski, the Mashgiach of Slabodka. I'm not 100% positive. And then there was I think that's true. And then also a lot of, like, Talmidim, and they were all, like, in hiding. And Rav Chanan, they knew that the end was near, but they were trying to stay very quiet. And the Nazis tracked down, there was a little like boy that looked Jewish and he was walking through the streets and they were like gingerly following him, and he basically was going to this house that was supposed to be a very secret house, but they followed him, and that's how they came into this house and they found Rabbi Chanan. I think he was giving a shiur.
Not being people.
On what?
But we can't become people.
Can't become?
Pigo.
Pigo. So we'll get to that in a second. That was later. Rochan was Stam giving a shiur, I think, on the mitzvah of Mesiras Nefesh, and then the Nazis or the Lithuanians came in. The Lithuanians were often worse than the Nazis. The local Lithuanian Gaim, they hated the Yidden more than the Nazis, if that's possible. And they basically they one of them saw Rabbi Chanan and his hadras upon him, and they just said, let's leave him alone, let's get out of here. So no, we're going to take him. And Rabbi Chanan, I think, asked to change into a Shabbos begadim. And then he led the whole chevra. They went to the seventh fort. There was a few forts, like these huge forts in the Lithuanian countryside, and they were used for. There was the seventh fort. There was the ninth fort, and Rav Chanan was killed in the seventh fort. And they're all today. Some of them were rebuilt, and you could still. There's like a museum there, and the burial grounds, I guess, of the. Where Rabbi Chanan is probably, the remains of Rabbi Chanan probably are, but it was a terrible place. That's where they mutilated a lot of the Yidden that were taken there. Weren't just killed, they were tortured. I think Rabbi Chanan also was very badly tortured before he was killed. And then before he was actually murdered, and there were, the reason why we know the story is because there was Rabbi Ephraim Ushri, who... He wrote a series of tshuva svarim called Mimamakim. And Mimamakim is a very famous series of tshuvas. During the war, he was like a paisik in the camps, and he didn't have any svarim. You know, if you're a paisik and you ask these crazy questions, and they're mamish crazy questions, so you need svarim to look these. You need Gemara, Shulchan Aruch. Rishayim, Achrayim, Shalos, Tshuva, Sarim. Each Sarim, he didn't have anything. He was in the middle of a
kind. What the whole point?
What?
Why they kept him alive?
They kept him alive because of what?
A continuing.
So Rabbi Chanan. So he was there when Rabbi Chanan said this, and he managed to escape.
They kept him alive because they wanted a museum of the good people we destroyed.
Yeah.
So they had him in charge of the books. Uh-huh. And therefore he was able to access the Sarim and Paskei Tshuvos.
Yeah, that's not the way I remember the story, but okay. But anyway, in the end of the day, after the war was over, he wrote down all of the Shilas that he was asked and the way he answered them, which was pretty incredible that he was able to answer. These Shilas are like the worst shilas of human, the human condition, the worst, the most gruesome and gory and heart-rending. And in fact, they wrote, I think Dr. Norman Lamb translated a lot of these letters, these tshuvas from Makim, not all of them, but he took, I guess, the most interesting ones, and he put them in a book. He published them together in a book. I forgot what it's called, From the Depths, maybe. I forgot what the name of the title was. But you can order it if you're interested in seeing it. But that's so we know the story. We have this Messiah through Rabbi Ephraim Ushri, who happened to be there when they murdered Rabbi Chanan. And this is what Rabbi Chanan's last words were. He said that we're for sure chosen to die al Kiddush Hashem, and we are karbonis now to Hashem. If we're dying al Kiddush Hashem, that makes us karbonis. We have a din of a carbon, he says, and therefore, if we're a carbon, we have to make sure that we're not pigel. We're not. A carbon can get messed up if you're thinking the wrong machshavas when you're bringing the carbon. You have to think the right. You have to have the right kabbanis. Has to be in the right zman, the right makam. Everything has to be, kedasu kedin in your machshava, and the kayin's machshava who's bringing it. It all has to be all good in the head. Says if we're carbonists, we shouldn't trafen up our carbonists. We shouldn't ruin the carbon by having a pigeldig machshava, like a bad machshava. So we should keep our carbonists pure, that we're going to die now at Kiddush Hashem. And then he said something remarkable. He said that we should have in mind that we are going to be able to atone and that through our death, we should bring life and success and Yiddishkeit and Ruchnias to our brothers and sisters in America. And he says that the pasuk says be'ish ata. We say it in Nachem on Tisha B'av, we say be'ish ata. So thank you. We say on Tisha B'av, Be'esh Yitzata, or Be'esh Ata Asa Levnaisa. With a fire, you destroy the Beis HaMikdash, and with a fire, you're going to, in the future, rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. So in other words, we're being killed with a fire, but this very fire that's being used to kill us is going to be the fire that will rebuild Klal Yisrael, and he's pointing to America. And so I always thought that, you know, the Lamaisa, American Yiddishkeit is such a, it's Lamaila Manateva, like we're living in it. So, you know, historians always need like maybe 100, 200 years to really get their brains around what happened. Like, it's like you can't write a biography or a history book about America in 2020, because you don't know the broad sweep of history. You don't know what happened afterwards. You know, you have to see, let's paskin how good a President Trump is. We don't know. Like, maybe, you know, he could be the best president of all time, or maybe something will happen terrible. So you need time for it. Historians need time to see the sweeping panorama, the sweeping arch of history. But we're living in the middle of a renaissance. We're living in very historic times, just we can't see it. But if you'd be able to look like from a bird's eye view of what happened in America over the last 75 to 80 years, or you would watch it like a graph, you would see like Torah was like sort of flatlining in the early 1900s. There was a few little Yiddishkeit in the Lower East Side, maybe a few Gedolim around America, but very little in terms of yeshivas, in terms of Torah learning. It was very, very schwach. You read books about All for the Boss, about Yechidim that were able to be Marbitz Torah to the extent that they were able to, and they sent boys to learn in the Mir. And, you know, there were Yechidim that were doing something, but it was very few and far in between. It was a real midbar. Then Rav Moshe Feinstein came, and then, of course, Aaron Kotler came, and the Hasidish Rebbes came, and, you know, the Bababar and the Satmar, and Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, and Rav Huttner, and Rav Uderman, and Rabbi Yaakov, and all the great Gedolim of America that came, and they worked very hard, and they built up Torah, but it was such a growth stock, America. Like, it went from such humble beginnings, and now you see what's going on in America. In every major or minor city, there's yeshivas, and there's kailim, there's Beis Yaakovs, there's mikvahs, there's chadarim, and there's daf yomi all over the country, and there are, you know, people at dirshu, and people are building shuls and building Tehran and publishing svarim, and you look what's going on in Lakewood. We're living in the golden age of American Jewry, but where did this happen? Why are we zeichet to such nisim? Why are we zeichet to such siat d'shmai? And I always thought that it might be the Rebbe Chanan's tefillah really was the thing that planted the seeds of America. That holy carbon, Rebbe Chanan Wasserman and the people that were with him, with that kavana, that might have been what caused America to have such a, all of us, like we're all great, we have to be grateful to Rebbe Chanan, because it might be that any reason that we are Yidden and we're from and we're able to learn a little bit is because of that one tefillah. Now, why was that one tefillah so important? Why? What made it so powerful, that one tefillah, if my theory is true? It's because this is a tefillah that wasn't stam a tefillah. It wasn't a tefillah, a regular mincha or shachas. That wasn't the time for that. It was everything. We needed so much rachamim at that time that it wasn't the regular tefillahs like the Gemara, the Daf just said the other day, like the Shari tefillahs were ninalu, they were locked the gates. You need an act of mesiras nefesh. You need to mamish, put it all on the line, give up your whole neshama to the Rabbeinu Shalom, and that's the tefillahs that shake the world. That's the tefillahs that changed everything. Rebbe Chanan's tefillah was not just Stam a tefillah. Rav Chanan's tefillah was a tefillah like Nachshon Menei Menadav. He was willing to go down in fire for Klal Yisrael. That act of Mesiras Nefesh was an act that was singular. You know, it's brought in the Mishnah Berurah that before you daven Kriya Shema, and you're saying Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, you're supposed to have in mind that you're dying al Kiddush Hashem. That's what I don't remember who he brings this from, but this is what Mishnah Berurah brings down. Anyone know where he cites this from? I don't remember. But this is what he said. If you look in the Hilchos Kriya Shema, he says you should have in mind that you're willing to be Meiser Nefesh al Kiddush Hashem when you say Kriya Shema. So when you're covering your eyes, you're supposed to maybe think on a certain level, like Rabbi Chanan, like, I'm willing to give it all up. I'm willing to give everything up. I want to die al Kiddush Hashem for you. Shema Yisrael Hashem, like Rabbi Chanan, like Rabbi Akiva died al Kiddush Hashem by saying Shema Yisrael Hashem, like Kiddush Hashem Echad. And Rabbi Chanan died with that. We also have to, we're not dying, Baruch Hashem, but we have to think as if we're dying. Why? It might be because of this Vart. If you just say Shema, all right, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't work, I don't know. But if you say Shema, and you have in mind that you're willing and ready, willing and able to be Meisah Nefesh al Kiddush Hashem, that creates, that turbocharges the tefillah, that gives it a whole new power that it didn't have before. So the sight of Shema Yisrael, which is so powerful, that it's a tenet of Emunah, we're proclaiming HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that tefillah is an amazing tefillah, Shema Yisrael. That's the tefillah that Klal Yisrael died al Kiddush Hashem, and they constantly said Shema before they were killed. That's the last words that come out of a Yid's mouth. But if you have in mind when you say Shema even tonight or tomorrow, and you have in mind that I am putting my mind in a frame of Mesiras Nefesh al Kiddush Hashem, it creates a whole new, you're not Shema and Aminadav now. The regular tefillah might not work, but that tefillah, that's like a formula for success. Every time you're willing to be Meiser Nefesh to Rabbeinu Shalom and then you utter a tefillah, it's a different tefillah. Different tefillah.
I thought it could be
Meiser Nachem. It's Ritzayin Chem. All right, that's a different Shema.